Life is full of awesome what ifs, and some not so much, like unexpected medical costs. That's why United Healthcare provides Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans to supplement your primary plan and help manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Hi, and welcome to Everything is Fine, a podcast for women over 40. We are your hosts, Talia Bacassus
and Kim France.
And today we have Nell Scovell, a legend in TV comedy, directing, and writing. And I want to get this right, so Nell, you can jump in, even though I haven't officially said hi to you, but if I do get this wrong, you're a writer on The Simpsons, Murphy Brown, Newhart. Famously, you were the second woman ever hired to write for Late Night with David Letterman. She was the creator of the show Sabrina the Teenage Witch, and she co-wrote the book that became a phenomenon, Lean In. In 2018, she wrote her own memoir, Just the Funny Parts, and I personally harassed Nell for months to get her on the show. So, hi, Nell.
Hi, thanks for having me. I'm 59. You're going to ask, so can we just get it over with?
Well, I'm not far behind you, Nell.
Fantastic. I like a proactive guest. So, tell us how you got into writing comedy for TV.
So, you know, it's interesting because I grew up and I always thought women were funny, right? I had these two hilarious aunts. My Aunt Jane was a great joke teller. You know, there's this whole belief that women can't tell jokes. She did the voices. She took her time. I unfortunately sort of internalized some of that women aren't good joke tellers, and I tend to speed through my jokes, but not Aunt Jane. She did all the voices, the setup, and always nailed the punchline. And then I had another aunt, my Aunt Pinky, who had this very mordant, dry wit. And I tell the story in my book about my sister Alice was on the sofa reading Little Women when we were young. Mm. And Pinky walked by her, tapped her on the shoulder,
yes,
and says, "Don't get too attached to Beth."
I'm sorry, I started laughing. I just remembered that part from the book. It was hilarious.
No, it's fine. And so, you know, and it was also this wonderful time when Joan Rivers was the guest host on The Tonight Show. And I thought she was way funnier than Johnny Carson. And so I just always thought women were funny. I mean, it's interesting. Why do you think men decided to start saying women weren't funny?
Well, because they were threatened by the women who were funny.
Right, because comedy is something of value. And unlike land or political clout, anyone could claim it, right? It was access.
Right.
Anyone had access to being funny. And so the people in power needed to find a way to limit it. And so you get that, like, it's not ladylike to make jokes. And when that didn't work, they just flat out started saying women weren't funny. You know, the sad thing is culturally, it stuck.
Yeah, it really did.
Yeah, they did a study not long ago out of the University of Arizona where they asked 200 people to react to male and female retail store managers giving the same presentation on sales performance. And in one, they asked the managers to use humor. There was a script. So both the men and the women were saying the same script. When the women used the humor, they were perceived as being disruptive. And the men who were funny were perceived as having high status. And everyone liked the women better when they didn't try to be funny.
So interesting.
That makes me think of, you had a chart in your book, too, that was also like about how women showrunners are perceived. That's kind of, it reminds me of what you're just saying, because it was like, men who argue a point, thoughtful. Women who argue a point, crazy. Men who miss deadlines, creative. Women who miss deadlines, crazy. Men who cry at work, sensitive. Women who cry at work, crazy. Like, the perception of it was different for both genders.
Yeah, I mean, you're either difficult or crazy or both. And, you know, that's something I try very hard to monitor in myself, too, because I'll go there also. I mean, I think one of the biggest lessons I learned from co-writing Lean In was how biased women are against women, how much we've internalized the bias.
No, I think women, I mean, I saw it all the time when I worked in fashion, women could be women's worst enemies.
Oh, yeah. And think of the judgment about women's bodies.
Oh, yeah.
From other women. It's just earth shattering.
But do you think women in your career have made you feel like you're not funny?
Less so, I think. No, I mean, I had some wonderful mentors, like Robin Schiff was a huge supporter of mine. She wrote Romeo and Michelle's High School Reunion. And I was really lucky that, you know, after I quit Letterman, I really needed a job and I wanted to come back to LA. And I had left, quit a sitcom job to go back to New York and write for Late Night, which was my dream job that turned out to be a nightmare. So I was just really lucky that Robin read a script of mine and put me up for a job.
It seems to me like the people I know who've written for TV and existed in TV writers' rooms, they just sound like the harshest places where you have to learn how to just throw out lines and not care if people shoot them down. How do you learn to have such a thick skin about things like that?
Well, I'm the middle of five kids, and I do think that was the best training. I mean, my siblings are all very funny and very verbal. So, and we had dinner together every night, and that was good training. And I don't have the don't interrupt people belief that I think stops a lot of women. But at the same time, I learned how to be very quick about my pitches, like surgical strikes. And one of the pieces of advice I give a lot of young women is, because we don't listen to women, women tend to repeat themselves. Have you noticed that?
Yes.
Yeah.
Like, you mean in a meeting?
In a meeting. And it's like, get in, say your piece, and get out.
Are you Jewish also?
Well, culturally, not rigid.
No, no, we're all culturally Jewish.
No, I'm just wondering because of the don't interrupting thing. I was like, well, I don't know anybody who's raised Jewish who doesn't interrupt people.
It's really true.
And you've also been a very outspoken critic of the ratios of men to women in the writers' rooms. I loved, there was a quote in the book, which is actually Alexandra Petrie, the hilarious writer who tweeted.
Love her.
Yeah, she's so funny. I wish I could take younger me and tell her, if you're the only girl in the room, it doesn't mean you're better. It means something is wrong. So what is that about?
Well, there used to be the phenomena of first and only. And for some people, that became this badge of honor that somehow this high status had been conferred on you. There's a belief that you're special. And I never really felt that way. Very early on in my career, I was on a show that was short-lived. And the best thing about the show is the writing partnership in the office next to mine was Conan O'Brien and Greg Daniels, who became lifelong friends and are hilarious, as the entire world now knows. But we were sitting around after the show got canceled, and we were all worried whether we would ever work again. And one of the other guys, a guy named Phil, said, well, Nell, you're lucky. And I was like, why am I lucky? He said, because every show's looking for a woman. And I said, a woman and one, nine yeah. men. How does that make me lucky? So even early on, I got that this ratio was not in my favor, even if I was that one woman who got through. You know, I've thought a lot about why I was able to break in and what made me a good culture fit. You know, I had this background as a sports writer, so I think that was helpful. I had gone to Harvard, even though I wasn't on the Lampoon because it was so intimidating to me. But that was another connection. I think I was, honestly, I was cute, but not so attractive as to be distracting. And I think that was helpful. I was one of the guys. I dressed, you know, they always say dress for the job you want. I dressed like a boy. I wore my t-shirts and my jeans, and I did work to fit in.
Right. When did you start speaking up? When did you start feeling like you had been around long enough and were confident enough to speak up about the inequities that you saw?
Well, I do think with age, there was definitely an outspokenness that came with age. And I knew throughout it hadn't seemed to get better in the early stages of my career. I was often the only woman in the room. And then I get to 2009 and I'm on a really fun show called Warehouse 13. And again, I was the only woman in the room. So that started me thinking. And then around that same time, David Letterman goes on camera and says, I have had sex with women who work for me, which was a surprise to no one who had ever worked with him. And Nancy Franklin, who's this amazing writer, she was at The New Yorker at the time, had written a column, I think it was about Jay Leno, and at the end noted that Leno, Letterman, and my old pal Conan, none of their shows had a single female writer on them. And so something inside me just broke and said, you've got to speak up. And so I did.
That's what led to your Vanity Fair article that called out David Letterman?
Right. It called them all out. And it basically, I knew all the arguments they could make. And so I set about debunking all those arguments in that piece and saying that you have no women because you don't want to have women on your staffs. And within a year, they had all hired women. I brought tokenism back, guys. Now, the shows are much better now. They're much, much better. They're not 50-50, but they're way better.
That was my question. I was wondering about that, if it has improved very much.
It has. It really has. So that gives me hope. And I think when you see the success of like Amber Ruffin, who is so amazing on Seth Meyers' show, you really appreciate how it's not good for the women. It's good for the show.
Right.
It broadens your audience. It broadens the kind of humor you can do. And it broadens your depth. I mean, the week after the George Floyd video and protests, did you watch, like, Amber Ruffin started the show each night with a different story about run-ins with the police that she had had. And they were really moving.
I didn't see them, actually.
Yeah.
One thing I really appreciate about your humor, Nell, is that it's not self-deprecating. It comes from a really confident place, I feel like. Is that intentional? Or do you even agree?
I do agree. I completely agree. Thank you for noticing. Kurt Vonnegut once summed it up beautifully. He said, some people are funny, some are not. And, you know, it's kind of hard to dissect what your own humor is. But I grew up loving Albert Brooks, who is self-deprecating.
Yes.
So
and
it's
Joan
not
Rivers,
like,
too.
Yes. I'm such a skeptical person. I question everything. And so I think that's where my comedy comes from.
How old were you when you realized you were really funny?
It's so hard because you can't judge it yourself. You know, I think I talk about how I think why people like comedy is because it has this instant impact. Like if you tell a joke and someone laughs, you feel that impact on the other human being.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. Like you get the instant feedback.
Right. And I will say that I remember getting in touch. This is after I had had a long, successful career with a high school friend of mine. And one of the questions I said asked her was I funny in high school? Because when I look back, I just think I was angry. And she said, no, you were really funny. But the two are kind of similar, right?
It reminds me of the 30 Rock episode when Tina Fey is, she's being in high school again. And
oh, that one's sad.
Perceives herself as being persecuted. And then the truth was she was like horrible to everyone.
I don't think I was horrible, but I was, I viewed everything through that lens.
I feel like it might be family background as well, because I feel like my brother and I view everything through, we joke about everything. And when my mother was dying at the hospital, she was in palliative care, my brother and I were cracking jokes to each other around her. And my father, who very much is not from that tradition, was horrified. And we were just like, this is how we process things. This is just how we deal. It's how we cope even with something that is very difficult. I feel like sometimes that's just the way you are.
Oh, I love that story. Because that's very much like my family. Although my dad is hilarious. And I'll tell you that the day after our mom died, all the kids were home. And at one point, my siblings, someone had ordered pizza and someone else was, they were handing money over to pay for it. And my dad, who was obviously very sad and confused, looked over at the exchange of money and said, what's going on? And I said, I think I said, like, Alice had yesterday in the death pool. And my dad looked at me and he said, I don't know whether to be horrified or proud.
Oh, my God.
We're going to take a quick break for some ads.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com. A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Welcome back to Everything is Fine.
You also worked at the late, great Spy magazine, and I remember your byline well there because I was working at 7 Days and then Sassy in those days, and I was so jealous. I was just so jealous of everything you guys were doing there. What an amazing time that must have been.
I was so lucky, and you don't know it at the time, but if in your 20s you get to work with people who say, go harder, be funnier, be edgier, it's so gratifying. And it pushes you in a way that, you know, so often I think we hold ourselves back, especially women. Mm-hmm. And they just kept telling me, go harder. And it was such a great lesson for me to hear at that juncture in my life.
And they also had women on staff at Spy. Susan Morrison had a very senior job there. It seems to me that that was a place that was pretty integrated gender-wise.
Let's not get carried away. And there was anyone of color.
Oh, God. Well, that's a huge problem in publishing. I mean.
Well, that's the other thing about the Letterman show. While its numbers of women were abysmal, in 33 years on the air, it had zero writers of color. Not one.
Wow.
I mean, that is so tragic when you think of all the careers that show started.
Yeah. Hmm.
Well, I wanted to circle back for a second to the Letterman story. The Vanity Fair article got a lot of attention, and it led to you sitting down with Dave Letterman and getting an apology. And so I want to know, what did that feel like?
So that's 10 years later. I wanted to do an update. And my first thought was, well, I'll just find out all the numbers and see what impact it made. And that seemed a little boring. And so I reached out to Dave's PR person, who I had actually become friendly with because I write about this in my book. In a weird twist, Dave and I end up working on the Kennedy Center honors together. So I reached out and he agreed to meet with me. And my stipulation was that he had to read this article I had written 10 years ago, which he claims he had not read. And if he did, I'm sure he forgot it. And then we just had a really good conversation about it.
I mean, the 10 year later article, you sort of say like, well, there was like an oops, sorry part of it. But then you did describe it as though he apologized more deeply for other things. Like, actually, another story that you wrote in your book was how you were coerced into a sexual act by a colleague because he had influence over your career.
It was by the head writer, not a colleague.
Which was fucking brave of you to put in your book.
Exactly.
It's funny because I wrote it before Me Too broke. And at first, I was really nervous about telling the story. And then between the time I wrote it and the book came out, Me Too breaks. And then I couldn't wait for the book to come out.
Did you consider not telling it?
Oh, of course. I mean, I considered taking it to the grave. And I think one of the reasons I wanted to tell it is because we're talking about women of a certain age, too. I think when you're young and you look at someone who's been successful, you kind of think, well, nothing bad ever happened to her. like she sailed through. She was able to do it. And I wanted to say, no, there were parts that really sucked. And there were mistakes I made. But, you know, there were uncomfortable, possibly criminal moments.
I liked how, though, the way you told the story and the moment when you're kind of like, you're putting your fingers through his hair like that.
His toupee.
Discover his rug. His toupee. Yes. But that, it felt so true to me of those moments that we all find ourselves in where we're like, am I into this? Oh, wait, I don't think I'm into this.
Right, like cat person.
Yeah, yeah.
I do think, I mean, and I do believe we mistake sexual power for actual power. Or as the great Gloria Steinem once said, if you could sleep your way to the top, there'd be more women at the top. In a way, it was good. It happened early in my career because I really never crossed that line again. And it was really helpful to me to feel that wall between personal and professional.
Right. Mm.
Just because you mentioned Me Too, I noticed that some of the actresses on Charmed, there was Alyssa Milano, Rose McGowan. I was like, is it a coincidence that so many of the women who have intersected with Nell's career are on the forefront of the Me Too movement? Like, what is up with that?
So I won't take credit. They're amazing. But I do wish someone would write an article about that. And there were others. Krista Vernoff was also, and she runs Grey's Anatomy, and she's written some amazing pieces for The Hollywood Reporter about sexism. But I will tell you, the link is that show, creatively, the engine of that show was all female, but all the executive producers and Spelling were male. And one of them, this guy Brad Kern, was fired from his job at NCIS for sexism and bullying. And I think we were, I don't know, victims isn't quite the right word, but that was an up-close cauldron, shall we say, of women doing a lot of the hard labor and the men actually impeding, but having the final say.
Right. Well, I found that in magazine publishing, too, because there were and had been for many, many, many years powerful women in magazine publishing, you know, back to the 30s, you know, but men were always at the tippy top.
Right. And still are, right. Pretty much.
Now, when people say that there aren't enough women directors or directors of color, they say there's a pipeline problem. Can you tell us about the op-ed you wrote for The Times about the broken doorbell problem?
So I don't buy into the whole pipeline theory. And it's a problem, too, with all these training programs and the assumption that these people like who are outside, who aren't white men, need more training. They don't. There's so many capable, talented people who could start tomorrow. And we just keep putting off the equality, right? Because if you say it's a problem in the pipeline, then you can just kick the can for another 10 right. years. But it is a broken doorbell problem because we're standing on the porch, ringing the doorbell, begging to be let in, and they're not opening the door.
Right. Mm-hmm. You wrote about how Kurt Vonnegut said that while men lose their sense of humor at 63, women lose it at 29.
I know.
29? It's just amazing. How did that make you feel?
Oh, terrible. From then on, I felt like I was on borrowed time.
Like, why? Why did he feel that way? What happened? I mean, once you have children, then it's all over? Or?
I think so. I think that's part of it. And you know, I used to, when I would start a new job and people would go around the room and be getting to know each other, inevitably someone would say, well, do you have kids? And I would always say yes to, but I'm blanking on their names. Because I didn't want to be seen as, you know, the mom, because moms aren't funny.
Right.
Moms are not cool.
Oh, the maternal penalty gap is real. I mean, it's been shown over and over, you know, that after having a kid, a woman's salary for the same number of hours goes down and a man's goes up.
So depressing.
Mm. Yeah.
You know, but one of my favorite shows these days is Better Things, which is about motherhood.
Right.
But she's lucky.
I mean, Roseanne was a big hit, so...
Right.
But here's what's interesting. So the first time I went to the Emmys was in 1990 with the Letterman show. And I'm sitting there in the audience and they announced the best comedies. And these were also huge hits. And it's Murphy Brown, Designing Women, Golden Girls, Cheers, and The Wonder Years. Hmm. 3.5 of these shows were created by women. Diane English wins that year for Murphy Brown. And it makes me so sad that it was so proven a long time ago that not only were women capable of creating popular shows that were critical successes, and then we just got pushed back. And I think it was the later Clinton years and then the Bush years were just a terrible time.
Hmm. But so back to the Kurt Vonnegut quote, you're 30 years past when your expiration date, basically. How is it working today?
Well, you mean in the middle of a pandemic and Trump's president? It's just the jokes keep coming. So, for example, I believe it's a good thing that there's political correctness. I actually think if you want to take away, you can't make fun of, you know, racism, or you can make fun of racism, but, you know, you can't make jokes about that are racial. It's like, all right, so you can make jokes about everything else in the world except that. That's okay. Would I have felt that way in my 20s? I'm not sure. I think I might have been more of a gonzo, everything's up for grabs kind of humor.
So you think you've become a little more
sensitive. I think the word you're looking for is sensitive.
Yeah, I was afraid to say it, but do you feel like people look at you differently or that you're sometimes on the other side of ageism?
Oh, I'm so fully on the other side of ageism. And, you know, it's real. The Writers Guild just came out with its inclusion report, and the hardest hit class was writers over 55. Mm-hmm. And despite making up 29% of the total U.S. population and 22% of the labor force, people over 55 were only 12% of TV writers employed in the last season. And that number's even smaller if you look under showrunners. So if writers at supervising producer, which is still a high level, or below, last year, writers over 55 were just 1%.
Wow.
And it's frustrating because if you're a lawyer and you're over 55, you are hitting your stride, right?
Right.
You're on the management team. You're enjoying your life and doing what you do best. And it's very frustrating. I still write spec scripts and people read them and they love the writing. And there's always a reason they don't get made.
It feels like an industry kind of almost like social media director or something where they just want the person just out of college.
Right.
Well, they're cheaper in addition to everything else.
Well, but there's the whole fresh voice. I mean, I think a lot of people over a certain age would be happy to work for, you know, sell ourselves short just to keep doing what we're doing. But I think everyone loves the potential, especially for women. We value the potential of young women more than we value the experience of older women.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we talk about that often on the show, that experience isn't the thing that's valued.
Yeah, I've been listening to, I know you had Corinna Longworth on your show, and she's doing this series on Polly Platt on You Must Remember This, and it's so good. And I wish I could say it's changed hugely from the 70s when she was coming up to the 90s when I was coming up, but it's, you know, you make strides forward and then get pushed back. I mean, nobody wants to give up money and power.
Yeah. Right.
There's something else that I wanted to know about personally. You had an enviable situation with a husband who wanted to stay home with the kids. And in the book, you kind of make it sound like it was an easy decision. And I wanted to know, is that something you guys talked about before having kids? Like, is that something that was in your deal almost?
Yeah, very early on when we had just started dating, he said to me, if you want to have kids, I'll stay home. And it was like the sexiest thing any man had ever said to me. I mean, that was my, you know, here are two tickets to Paris. You know, we're leaving on the Concorde. Right. I think originally, probably, he was an architect. So financially, I made a lot more money. He's younger than I am. He's 6 years younger. So I also was further along in my career. So that all made sense. And then he was really good at it and he enjoyed it.
Right.
And he was still able to do some work while the kids were young. He built an amazing castle on a mountaintop near Vegas for a magician who will go nameless. But it's an incredible building. And so I think he had enough creative fulfillment. And he was a partner. He read every script I ever wrote. He's super funny. So yeah, we had a good thing going.
So nice. Speaking of nameless magicians, I loved how Penn Jillette told you, Nell, you're a terrible mother, but you're the world's greatest dad.
I know. And how first, like, it really, I felt this dagger to my heart and then went, oh, he's right.
Yeah, more women should be the world's greatest dad. I love that. So I can't tell if you're going to hate this or not, but we have a new feature where we're asking
the beauty stuff.
We're both scared you're not going to like our question.
Yeah, exactly. I'm like terrified you're not, because you seem like you're way above that. But everybody wants to know, what is your number one beauty product?
It's so unfair. I feel like so much is genetic. So I have my younger sister, no wrinkles, totally gray hair. Me, tons of wrinkles, don't dye my hair. And it's just that so much of these things are the luck of the draw. But I mean, I do have can I give advice for women?
Yeah, of course.
So I know you talk about mentoring on your show. And as I've gotten older, I really do believe mentoring needs to go both ways. Because older women may have connections, but younger women have relevance. And I think it's got to become more transactional. Like when I help young women, it's not out of maternal feelings. Like I want to create a network. I don't want you to replace me. I want us to boost each other and, you know, open that door wider for even more women. So that's one part of mentoring. And then the other part is I really think 50-year-olds, for example, need to encourage 70-year-olds as much as they encourage 30-year-olds. Because what I see older women, and I find myself inching up to this line, is you reach a point where you're like, what's the point? I'm invisible. It's hard enough to write this stuff. And then I have to go back to dealing with rejections and I'm just going to enjoy my life, which is fine. But you also, so many of these women have so much to say. So, you know, I've urged a lot of women to write memoirs, get their stories down. You know, we're all obsessed with Hamilton, who lives, who dies, who tells your story. Like, no one's going to tell your story unless you do. And so especially for writers, you have the means. And again, back to like this podcast about Polly Platt, you know, her memoir was never published, but you know, you listen to her story and you're so grateful that she put down her feelings about those days. So we need to help each other as much as we help younger women, I guess is my point. Does that make sense?
Of course.
I love it, yeah.
Also, like 70-year-old women are like the most interesting people on earth.
So agree.
It's really true. I especially think that the closer I get to 70.
Me too.
I want to believe it.
Thank you so much, Nell. This was really,
Nell.
Fun.
Oh, good. Thanks for having me.
So listeners, go out and get Just the Funny Parts for an unflinching insider look at the TV writing and directing world in Hollywood. And it's very, very funny, despite being about also terrible sexism.
Really funny.
Really funny.
Like you guys.
Aw.
Is there another way that you want people to find you?
Oh, I'm Nellsco, N-E-L-L-S-C-O, at Twitter.
That's good.
Follow me.
Follow her. Thanks so much for listening to Everything is Fine. We are your hosts, Talia Bacassus
and Kim France.
If you like the show, be sure to rate it and write us a review on Apple Podcasts. And if you have suggestions for show ideas or anything else, you can reach us at tallyandkim@gmail.com. We also have an Instagram that is EIF Podcast, and you can find Kim on her blog, girlsofacertainage.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.